You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Bit of an odd one this week, isn't it, Lionel?
Very. I mean, this is the off-season, isn't it? I
hope we get away with this.
Well, people are listening for free. I mean, they can always stop listening now or carry on listening.
Yeah, if you don't want to listen anymore, press stop now. Go and listen to something else. But we're recording this intro after recording the podcast. Now, it was a meeting with Jonathan Vauters of EF Education First, presented by Drapac, powered by Cannondale.
I think something that's like that. Cool.
Anyway, we obviously spoke to him about what's gone on with his team and its last minute rescue and the new sponsor. I was very interested to hear about the new sponsor and how and why they're sponsoring a cycling team and what they want out of it. So that's all very interesting. Now, Jonathan had his wife, Ashley, with him. Lovely Ashley, who's a wine expert, I think we can say, certainly.
Well, she knows a lot more about wine than we do. I know
that doesn't make her an expert.
No, that's true. I'm damning with faint praise a little bit there, but we'll hear, won't we, exactly what her wine credentials are. My wine knowledge extends to identifying wines by colour and price. I'm being slightly facetious.
You know your wine, Lionel. We got a message from Jonathan when he was on his way over saying that, asking us to order wines from different cycling regions, she would then identify them. She wasn't too happy about that.
No, we had to point out that that hadn't been our idea. But we're in the Connaught Bar in the Connaught Hotel, and the wine list is a little punchy. I saw one of the wine by the glass. One was £68, so obviously avoided that one. There were some much more reasonable ones.
To get your wine app out and check what it actually costs.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to try and do was get one from Spain, one from Italy, one from France to represent the three Grand Tours. But Jonathan sent a text saying we're coming, we're 2 minutes away, hurry up. So I ordered the wines as best I could. And unfortunately, because the service here is so exclusive and so good, they bring the bottle to the table and talk you through, and obviously then you taste it to make sure it's not corked, and so it kind of spoiled the blind taste test.
So that ruined that. But the other thing that we were preoccupied by and distracted by a little bit was the presence of John Kerry, who is a former Secretary of State, a keen cyclist, somebody who was at the Tour de France this year with the team and who helped them try and find a new sponsor. And he is staying here, and we were sort of awaiting his appearance with the promise of getting him on the podcast. That didn't quite happen in the end, although he did come and chat to us.
He did come and chat to us, and I think he possibly wanted to check out who we were. We weren't just a couple of jokers. Obviously, we are a couple of jokers.
If we hadn't been, he might have appeared on the podcast.
But we explained about the cycling podcast and explained that we're sponsored by Rafa, and he said, really lovely stuff. Big fan of Rafa, John Kerry. I don't know whether that's breaching a confidence, is it? But he did actually say that. I'm not making it up. He's got his own bike brand that he's been developing.
A Rollo. Do you love anybody enough to give them your last Rollo?
And we hope to talk to him. I've particularly wanted to ask him whether he was aware of the Tour de Trump, the big stage race in the late 80s, early 90s that bore the name of the current president, Donald Trump. I would have been fascinated to know what John Kerry thought of Donald Trump's old bike race.
Well, you can probably guess what he thinks of Donald Trump. But I was keen to ask him about his cycling, but we didn't. So we're kind of building up an interview that didn't happen here.
We were explaining what happened in the little chat we had with the 2 minute chat we had with John Kerry.
We've lined him up for a future episode, I think.
He said he wants to come to the Tour de France next year, and I'm sure we'll be, if not first in the queue, certainly in the queue to talk to Mr. Kerry then.
Yeah. Well, without further ado, shall we hear from Jonathan Vauters, who is the person we were, after all, here to see? Here's Jonathan Vauters and Ashley Vauters. We are joined today by two people. maybe a third, who knows? Jonathan Vaughters. Hello, Jonathan.
How you doing, Richard?
And Ashley Vaughters, your wife.
Hello.
Is this your first cycling podcast, Ashley?
Yeah, this would officially be my first cycling podcast.
Great. And you're in London. Well, you've been in London for a few days for the Ruler Classic. You've been talking a lot about the team saved from the brink of extinction. And you launched the new kit last week. Is it orange or pink?
Okay, so the training kit is orange and the racing kit is pink. And that orange is actually a specifically designed orange for maximum high visibility in traffic, high traffic conditions. So that's the idea. Is it's a safety kit, and then the racing kit is less safe.
Less safe. I like that. The orange also harks back to the very early days of Slipstream and Argyle and everything.
Yeah, that orange that we originally put on the uniform in the early days was directly derived from the couch in Doug Ellis's office. That's literally where we got that orange. It was, well, this couch is really cool. Why don't we put the couch on the uniform? And so our design level of expertise has grown since then.
I'm curious, though, how quickly all that has happened. You know, EF, Education First, is that what we
Correct,
have to
that's
call
exactly,
it?
Yeah.
Not EF or Education
well,
First.
Well, you can call it EF Education First, or you can just call it EF. But you can't call it Education First.
This is going to be tricky, isn't it, Lionel?
We've got Jonathan dictating our podcast style guide already.
You've only just stopped calling them Garmin about 2 weeks ago. But, Jonathan, the everything seems to have come together pretty quickly from them agreeing to take over the team, the sponsorship of the team. Well, I mean, that was a sort of happened in phases as well, didn't it, from agreeing to back you to save you next year to agreeing a three-year deal and ownership effectively of the team. It seems to have all happened quite quickly, just a matter of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it was really complex, and it happened quickly because people were, you know, willing to work 18 and 20 hour days to make it happen. It was, you know, the whole thing was it was a really hard deal to get through, but the core of that was that, you know, EF Education First really wanted to do the deal, you know, and sort of save the team. And so that deal for 1 year we came to fairly quickly. But I sort of just had a little bit of a personal moment where I said, I don't want to be doing this again next year. And so I circled back around with them. And of course, you know, in addition to that, Doug and I had, and I don't want to get too far down this rabbit hole because then it'll raise all kinds of questions, as people always are questioning things in cycling. But we had another team that was actually offering to buy our license. And so since we had that capacity to just sort of like almost sell the team to a different entity and then just walk away and say, okay, everyone's jobs are saved and we're out and, you know, and that's it. We said, okay, we have a reason to go back to EF and say, listen, this can't just be 1 year. And so we went back to them and said, you know, this has got to be 3 years. And basically they said, and nine times out of 10, when you go back on a deal like that, you ruin the deal and, you know, they just walk because they're just like, well, you know, you can't renegotiate this after the fact. What, you know, and in this case they said, okay, we're listening. But we want to know what your organization is all about behind the scenes. So they came and they went through our books at the offices and so on and so forth. And then they came back to us and said, here's the deal. Like, you know, we understand this is extremely unstable revenue. We can see that how you guys have sort of pieced this together through the years. We're willing to do a much longer term commitment, but we need to own the team. You know, we need to own the team, not just sponsor the team, because we need to have sort of control over this craziness. And so then it all of a sudden turned into a buy and a sponsorship, which required a lot of people to sign off on. I mean, you know, Cannondale had to be okay with that. Drapac had to be okay with that. Doug of all had to be okay with that. So it turned into a really complex deal, but that's how we got to where we are today.
I mean, what does that mean in a practical sense that they will own the team? And what does it mean for your role within the organization?
You know, we had dinner with the chairman last night, Philip Holt.
He lives in London.
Yes, he lives in London. Yeah, the chairman of EF, lives in London. And as he put it, he said, you know, we needed to look at this in a sort of a 15-year time horizon. And that's the way we operate as a company. And if you look at them as a company, it's absolutely true. Like when they buy a company or when they invest in something, they stick in there and they recapitalize it. And like with China, which is their biggest revenue producer right now, or one of their biggest, you know, he would say when we initially went in there, we just lost money hand over foot, but we hung in there and now it's really turned around for us. And that's sort of their philosophy as a company in general. It's not the turn 'em and burn 'em stuff that we see, you know, with a lot of tech companies, especially in the U.S., you know, get the IPO, boom, jet it out. They're a more steady Eddie wins the race kind of mentality. And I think that, so that was, he needed to, you know, to feel that, like that, okay, we're in this for like 10 years. And is there a 10-year contract? No, that's not what I'm claiming. But they own the team. So in essence, the deal could be 3 years, it could be 10, it could be 15, it could be 20. I mean, they own it. It's, you know, it's up to them.
How did you feel when it looked as though the team might go out of business? I mean, how did you feel at the prospect of perhaps stepping away from a sport that you've been involved in for decades?
I mean, I'm only sort of starting to realize it now because things have turned around and it's in it, but they're almost like huge chunks of time that I don't even have real clear memory of, you know, in that sort of year before. I mean, don't forget about the few weeks before, because that was really bad. But the year before, when it's just sort of like looming and you're trying to figure it out and you're not figuring it out and you're putting one piece in the puzzle, but then another piece of the puzzle falls away and whatever. And, you know, it's kind of a realization now that I seem to be in a little bit of a happier place. Like I was just, you know, depressed is the best way to put it, because it's just like there was not a forthcoming solution, and it was really hard for me to, you know, say, here's the problem, here's how we can solve the problem, and damn it, nothing's moving. You know, what is going on here? You know, and it just, yeah, put me in a funk. I mean, as Sebastian Drapac, Michael Drapac's son, said at our post Tour de France party, you know, after Rigo finished second and everyone's like whooping it up and having a great time at the party and whatever else. And he turned to me and he just said at like midnight, he's like, I haven't seen you smile once. He's like, you just put a rider on the podium of the Tour de France with one of the smallest budgets in the world tour. What, like, why are you not smiling? And I couldn't tell him at that moment. You know, at that moment, I just said, oh, you know, don't worry about it. It's all good. I'm having fun, which was bullshit. I wasn't.
I was going to ask, though, it has seemed over the last a decade the team has been around that your role has changed, you know, from being ever present and being around a lot of races to more of a, you know, you spend less time at races and you've been a bit more distant from the team. Was that an impression you had as well? And you've got other interests and other things going on as well, obviously, but have you felt less involved with the team, or has it always been the central thing?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, my biggest job for the last 18 months, 2 years really, has been keeping the team funded. I mean, you know, listen, we could have fallen apart had Drapac not come in when he did. So there's been these multiple steps where, like, exterior, from your perspective, it probably looks sort of like seamless transitions and new sponsors coming in and so on and so forth. From my perspective, it's always there have been multiple times we've been coming within weeks of not being able to, like, move forward. And so my job has been to stay focused on that side of it, on the business side of it. And I don't even like, you know, it's a sponsorship sales isn't something I love, but it's just, you know, that's been so critical that essentially I kind of have to be available 24/7, 365 for that. And going to races, I mean, believe me, I love going to races. It's much more fun for me going to races than sitting around and just praying that somebody in an office in New York is going to call me back. You know, that's no fun. But going to races is a lot of fun, but I just haven't been able to do that.
Nevertheless, has this, and especially the response from people to the crisis, the crowdfunding, all that, do you feel that's kind of reinvigorated your enthusiasm for it?
Absolutely. I didn't really know that people cared so much about the team. For the last few years, as you guys would be intimately familiar with, I read a lot of negative stuff on social media and a lot of nasty, very personal attacks on me and just sort of a constant, you know, vitriol directed right at me. And you know, I thought nobody likes us. Nobody likes me. Nobody likes us. Nobody, you know, I mean, that's sort of where my head was at in a lot of ways before all of this. And then this made me realize, wait a minute. I mean, okay, I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name on air, but, you know, Digger even wrote on Twitter, like, you know, good luck, JV, hope the team serves, something along those lines, which was, wait, well, what, who? Is it, wait, really? So it totally changed my attitude toward the whole thing. I mean, the amount of money we raised in crowdfunding, the amount of support we got, the amount of positive media that came out of it was unbelievable. It was okay, wow, people really care about this team. I don't know, maybe that's the reason they're always pissed off with us, is that they really care about us.
So what happened with the crowdfunding money now that the EF Education First have come in and actually effectively taken over ownership of the team?
Have you seen the new McLaren model?
Well, some
that's
of it,
the one
some
week outside, is it?
I've got to say, some of it's going on this wine. So,
yeah, exactly. Now, all of that money is going into two aspects, sports science insider program, and then also basically sort of career transition athlete education, which is something that Michael Drapac is immensely passionate about. And It's helping athletes become whole human beings so that when they retire from cycling, they can move into a different job and that there's not this like horrible emotional and, you know, workforce transition. So that's where the funding is going. And listen, that feeds into the anti-doping effort. If there's less pressure about the, you know, your money-making time in your life, it kind of pulls back the pressure as it, you know, adds to the anti-doping effort. So that's where we're putting the funds. In two areas that I feel like were needed. And the interesting thing is we actually asked a lot of people, you know, do you want us to give this back? And the overwhelming response was, no, use it to make the team better. We don't want it back. So, again, very flattering.
How much was raised in the end?
Well, with the matching, it was over $1 million. Over $1 million.
Quite incredible. It's such an intriguing sponsor, such an unusual sponsor. And a lot of people have remarked on how, you know, professional cyclists are, a lot of them are good ambassadors for speaking foreign languages, which I guess is one thought that comes immediately to mind. But have you got a sense at this stage of what the sponsor wants to get out of it and how they think they can use cycling?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, EF has 47,000 employees worldwide. They're in a huge number of countries all around the world. Obviously, their biggest business is teaching English around the world, a lot in China, a lot in Europe. They also teach a bunch of other languages. They also have a education travel business. They've got a lot of really fascinating business. But they're a very sort of per dollar of revenue, they need a lot of employees. They need a lot of people to move things. So internal morale and recruitment internationally is something that's really crucial for them. So developing like a center point branding effort to sort of do something cool, interesting, fun, forward-looking, athletic, able to bring in younger employees, you know. The second part of it is just pure branding. Did you guys know who EF was before?
No.
So it's a huge company that just kind of goes below the radar. And they've always been incredibly successful with just direct sales. But they've gotten to the point in their growth where they're saying, okay, we need to actually develop a brand. We need to be known who we are. We need to make a splash because that's sort of the next step for us to really capitalize on our direct sales efforts. So it's those two things. It's basically three things: employee recruitment, employee morale, and then just straight up branding, like good old fashioned branding, which is great.
I mean, speaking to Joe Dombrowski a couple of weeks ago, he was curious as to the comings and goings within the team. He wondered whether the likes of Sasha Modolo, who I understand doesn't speak any English, whether there was some thinking behind some of the recruitment of riders with regard to what the company does and whether the riders would be used in some way by EF Education First to, you know, as I say, role models for what they do. But also, is that an aspect of it at all, or is that...
I didn't recruit that way at all, no. So, yeah.
You're not recruiting case studies.
No, I'm not recruiting case studies. We recruited based on sort of... I mean, obviously, we were very late to market, and we lost a lot of guys. But we recruited based on who we thought would fit and who was available. And, you know, we had to rework the team. I mean, we're kind of a sprinter team next year. I mean, my personal opinion is that Sasha Modolo is a massively underrated, you know, sprinter for like Milan San Remo and some of the, you know, he's a hilly, almost like Blasenhagen kind of, you know, guy that's really strong and he can sprint as well. He's massively underrated, hasn't had great team support, is finally in a position where he's going to have great team support. And then Dan McClay, I feel like Dan is like the next great sprinter that has had zero team support. Now, he had a bit of an off year this year, but in 2016, I mean, he was running Cavendish and Kittel like really close. So we recruited accordingly to that, bringing on Matty Breschel, and some other guys that can really do an appropriate lead out. So, you know, we had to shift the tack of the team entirely. And it was just based on, okay, like, you know, what can we do based on the situation that we have? And so it's kind of like the team's gone from, you know, a bunch of fresh-faced kids like Davide Formolo and Alberto Bettio, which I love. This guy's massively talented, and I think that we did a great job developing over the, you know, the three and some odd years that we had them. But, you know, now our team is, it's a different feel. I mean, it's a, you know, we're no longer going to be the youngest team in the World Tour. We you know, we just got guys that are, you know, they're out there to get it done and you know, win some races.
The anti-doping philosophy that has been really important to the team right from the start, and was sort of almost the raison d'etre at the beginning of the team, it seemed, when you first came to Europe especially. I presume that was something that EF Education First were very keen to look into and establish was still very important to the team, because I guess for a lot of people it's maybe become a bit less visible over the years. It's just become assumed rather than explicitly stated.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. I mean, that's the core, you know, to our philosophy, our mentality, our ethos. That's 100% there. That is one of the reasons that they came in as a sponsor. Absolutely. Interestingly, you know, Philip Holt, the chairman of EF, he's intimately familiar of sort of all of the goings on, you know, of, you know, what I've said, what I did, you know, so on and so forth. And he views it as a sort of a philosophy that's very much in parallel sync with their company philosophy. And, you know, that's great to hear. Like, we don't have to, you know, put into place some whatever policy that you can't actually enact and or whatever else. We can actually just do what is pragmatically the best for the athletes and the organizations in terms of anti-doping, you know, and just execute on, like I said, what is pragmatically best for that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 20% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20 at the checkout. So get your 20% off there. We have a few things coming up, don't we, Lionel? We've got in a couple of weeks, we've got a show at the Arts Theatre in London, sold out. Fortunately it's sold out. And thank you very much to everybody who's coming there. 350 of you. Our biggest event to date. Daunting. Have you lost the ability to speak?
Well, I mean, I just hope I don't get stage fright. What are we going to talk about?
Oh, we've got plans, Lionel. We've got friends joining us, so we'll have company. We are also doing an event the previous week with Ciro Scognamiglio, our Italian friend from Gazzetta dello Sport, at Rafa and Spitalfields. That was also, the tickets had all gone, but I gather one or two may be available again. So have a check on the Rafa website and see if you can get tickets to an evening with Ciro Scognamiglio. We will be recording that and releasing it as a podcast. So if you can't make it along, you will hear it. A lot of you have asked whether we're recording our event at the Arts Theatre. Sadly, we're unable to do that, so apologies for that. But we will be doing events in the new year, and we'll be announcing details of them very soon, and they'll be throughout the country. So stay tuned. We're going to announce that very, very soon in the next couple of weeks.
It's a tour of Britain, but there's some big old transfers, isn't there?
I mean, well, it wouldn't be a tour of Britain without big transfers, would it?
True. True. Oh, dear. Sorry, Mick Bennett, if you're listening.
Anyway, back to Jonathan. So in this very nice bar with which we're very familiar, Lionel, being a regular haunt of ours, we're drinking some very nice wine. Ashley, can you tell us what we're drinking here? Because you're the wine expert.
Sure. Well, looks like we have a little bit of all three styles of still wine that you'd expect: white, red, and rosé, which has been one of the fastest climbing trends, the dry rosé, in the past few years. You have a pretty traditional Provençal rosé.
I also seem to be drinking the fastest of everybody.
I don't know. You guys are all doing pretty well. Pretty on par with one another.
It's not a race.
Exactly. Well, in my profession, I have to drink a little slower because I'm exposed to it probably a little more than most people are. And you and I are having the Saint-Aubin, which is, I think, one of the more overlooked values that you can find in white Burgundy, especially considering the last few vintages that have been pretty harsh. I mean, they've really had a kind of a hard go of it the last 5-6 years in terms of hail and frost, other kinds of damage that has resulted in some pretty low yields. And then moving to the red wine, we have another Burgundy with Gevrey Chambertin, from kind of one of the first producers I was ever introduced to, Frédéric Magnan. And that's a beautiful red from the Côte de Nuit, considered some of the more long-lived and complex reds.
Well, Jonathan suggested I order three different wines from cycling regions, and when I looked at the wine list, apart from, the Tour of Austria, there's an Austrian white on there, I think, on the on the wine list. But
what you said, Lionel, was I don't know any cycling regions.
I did say I don't know any cycling regions other than France, Spain, Italy. I gather Belgian wine is excellent. I went for the Gevrey-Chambertin because the Tour actually went through there this year.
Oh, yes.
Actually went, right through all the vineyards and through the town as well.
Sure. So it finished in Nuit-Saint-Georges.
Which was, we had some nice wine there, didn't we, Richard?
Nice.
And I know, Richard, you enjoy a rosé during the Tour, don't you?
Oh, yeah, that's a perfect wine for the summertime and during the Tour.
And the white Burgundy is taking me back to July and hot weather and cold wine. Very pleasant. Not perhaps for a cold November day in London, but...
No, I think it's perfect. I think, as we get into cold months, white Burgundy sounds perfect. White Rhones, white Burgundies, a little bit richer white. So, I think it's spot on.
Cycling and wine are happy bedfellows, eh?
Yeah.
It seems that way. We went to this this Burgundy Fest in Boulder, mm-hmm. and it was interesting. Like, every person there was talking about, when you ride through the vineyards here and you ride through the vineyards there, and then, of course, you've got...
I think we've hooked up pretty much everybody in my industry now. Like, we love talking about bikes and wine, and everybody just... everybody's really into it.
Well, before you carry on, Jonathan, tell us what your qualifications are, your credentials as a wine expert.
Yeah, so I mean, I've done quite a few certifications now. I went through level 2 through the Court of Master Sommelier, so certified sommelier. I did the Society of Wine Educators a degree, and then I really launched into the Wine and Spirit Education Trust in order to do what I needed with the diploma in order to apply for the Institute of Master of Wine, which I just completed. So that's why I'm here in London, is to receive my certification at Vintners Hall tomorrow for the Master of Wine.
So I'm going to brag for a second here on this. So just to be clear, so there are around 360 Masters of Wine in the world. Generally speaking, the whole process takes around 8 years to complete, and the pass rate is from start to finish?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
It's not
an easy degree, for sure.
One thing I wanted to ask Ashley was, cycling is a very traditional world in Europe, and perhaps not now, but when Jonathan first came over to Europe, Americans still were seen as outsiders in a traditional world. Has it been similar in the wine world, or is it changed in the time you've been involved? Or the Europeans, I'm imagining, think that European wine is, still the
best. I see what you're asking. I don't know. I mean, it depends on who you're talking to. If you're in France and you are in Châteauneuf-du-Pape in the southern Rhone, you're not really going to drink anything other than Châteauneuf-du-Pape. It's not even just this idea that European wine is better than American wine. It's the wine from my village is what I drink. I would say that in my experience, Americans have taken it to a hobbyist level that you don't always find just with every, a lot of Europeans, unless you're in the trade, for sure. Honestly, when I have a lot of winemakers come over to visit our market, because I work on the importing side of the business and distribution, that's all they want to drink is American wine. They're fascinated by it. They love how many options we have. You're going to find so many diverse options around the world, and that's actually really exciting for people that aren't, if you go to France, you're going to go to a grocery store, you're not going to see much other than French wine. No, I think that there's a human curiosity for everything. And, since modern winemaking, really since the advent of stainless steel, temperature control, I mean, the last 30, 40 years have brought on the best quality wines we've ever seen. And so we can taste South African wines. We can taste South American wines and be incredibly pleased.
How does the 2018 tour look for wine? I haven't seen the map
yet.
It doesn't hit so many wine regions, but in France, you're going through it all. Unfortunately, it doesn't go up the Ventoux, so that's always a sad sad day. I mean, we would probably have to, that's a whole separate thing where we'd have to match up sort of like each stage and see, because Ashley's so much more familiar with these sort of small wine growing regions that aren't well known. But, you know, the big ones, the Tour doesn't do Bordeaux, it doesn't do Burgundy, and it doesn't do Chateauneuf-du-Pape this year, but I'm sure there's a million other ones that I'm not, you know, that I'm not thinking of. Anyway, I was just going to say there are only 360 masters of wine in the world, and she has become one of them, which is, you know, an incredible honor. Which is actually why I was I'm in London. I did the Ruler thing and the kit launch as sort of a byproduct of wanting to, you know, be with her, as you know, she becomes one of the very, 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 very few wine professionals that has actually been able to work her way through this process. So
while you were away, she was saying what a good cyclist you were. So Ashley, are you a cycling fan as well? And do you, I mean,
I'm a cycling fan.
Still
sounded like,
no,
that
a lot of people ask me if I am a cyclist, and I am not a cyclist, but I do love watching the races and following especially his guys and watching them grow and flourish. I love watching Jonathan coach a couple of them individually and to see them improve. And I think the business of cycling is fascinating, and there is a lot of overlap in terms of, I mean, you wouldn't think so, but there actually is a lot of overlap in terms of the dynamics, the inner dynamics, the community.
Ashley mentioned that the coaching, Jonathan, and I said earlier how you'd appeared to not be as visible, not be as around the team, but this is something you've started the last couple of years, and I guess that keeps a day-to-day involvement with a lot of the riders. How many of the riders on the team are you coaching now?
Yeah, six. You know, it fluctuates up and down a little bit, but yeah, right now I'm coaching six of the guys, and which has been immensely rewarding and a lot of fun.
Who can you name them? We know Joe's one. Dylan Van Barle was one, but he was one.
Yeah. I know. Sadly,
still going to coach him at Team Sky.
Suddenly, massive training load for Dylan next year. Yeah,
I'll wait to reveal who the six are until next year.
Do you feel? I mean, there must be quite a pressure when you're their boss and also their coach.
It's a weird dynamic. It's especially when it comes around to contract time. Exactly.
You could maybe make them tail off a bit of the
I would never do that. No, you have to keep sort of a strict line between church and state on that. So.
Jonathan, have you finished recruitment for next year? Because one of the things we've noticed the last few weeks has been that squad sizes are down generally for next year. But finished? You're done.
25 guys.
And that's maybe not exceptionally low, but there are squads with fewer numbers. What do you think that will mean? Obviously team sizes are smaller in the big races next year, but do you think it'll have an impact?
Wait, hold on one second, guys. Do you mind if we're all done with doing the wine part of the interview and speaking about that I can go introduce my wife to John Kerry real
course,
fast?
Of course, of course.
Okay, just one second, and then we'll move on.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Yeah, John Kerry, it was rumoured or reported that he was helping. It was actually on the podcast you said this. He was helping with the search for a new sponsor. Was he quite important in that?
You know, he, for lack of a better word, busted his balls to help us out. You know, the EF connection was not directly through him, but he was out there pounding the streets. I mean, it was, you know, I joked quite a bit with Doug Ellis at the time that, you know, we had a new member of our Salesforce team, and that was John Kerry. I mean, he really went out there and rattled some cages to try to get something to shake free.
Going back to the question about team sizes, Is this something you expected with the team sizes in the big races?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if the big races are going to reduce by one rider, the teams are going to reduce their team size, too. I mean, it just follows logic.
I've often said, I think we discussed this last year when you were over and we did our Future of Cycling event, that to me, squads have seemed too bloated, but the calendar also is too bloated. Are you generally in favor of streamlining both the calendar and the squad?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, from a business perspective of running a team, it's a great thing. You know, smaller, I mean, listen, it reduces the pressure of how many teams the Grand Tours can invite, because they can invite a few more. It reduces the peloton size potentially. It reduces the cost of our team. It reduces the overhead. There's a lot of upsides. It makes the races more unpredictable. Theoretically, it reduces the dominance of the larger budget teams. I'm not sure that'll work out, but we'll see. There's all kinds of positives, right? But to revert back to my days as a writer, like, I don't understand whether the writers' union was actually consulted about this. I don't have a view into that, and it seems a little bit odd. And then the second part that hurts, you know, whatever, my bleeding heart a little bit, is that, you know, that ninth guy in a grand tour, that eighth guy in Perry Nice roster, whatever, when you're selecting your rosters, those guys are on, a lot of times sort of somebody that's on the bubble, somebody needing a second chance, a really young rider, you know, that's coming up. And so all of a sudden, you know, as you reduce team sizes, it becomes more and more just top guys go to top races. That's it. And the, you know, the one 22-year-old that gets to do his grand tour, first grand tour, whatever else, that starts to dissipate out the back.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're a year on from when we were trying to get a handle on how the sport might remodel itself or evolve over time. But you're absolutely right. There almost needs to be a kind of a tiered system within the safety of the World Tour where you can develop riders and you know, have development spots in races, maybe not in the Tour de France or the Giro maybe, or the Tour of Flanders, but in other races, you know, kind of almost like a mandatory development, you know, where the riders are almost categorized and you have to pick your guys for, so these are our leaders, these are our workers, and these are our development riders.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to start making team sizes smaller, then that needs to start happening, like a very, you know, it's almost like more strictly tiered system, and that, you know, pro teams are allowed to operate, like imagine if grand tours are six riders or whatever, okay, fine, then I can operate on an 18 rider roster, maybe smaller. But then you need to sort of almost like oblige the World Tour teams to also be carrying a continental team so that, you know, I mean, that's the way I think about it anyway.
Any thoughts, Jonathan, on the new UCI president? How well do you know him? Have you spoken to him?
I really don't know him at all. You know, I've voiced my concerns that he seems to be very aligned with ASO. Hopefully he will prove to be his own man and, you know, keep the equilibrium alive in the sort of the political ecosystem of cycling.
What would you like him to do?
I mean, honestly, I'd like him to carry on a lot of the things and continue to execute a lot of things that Brian Cookson initiated, which is, you know, the reformation of the CADF and, you know, increased funding into anti-doping, anti-doping research, anti-doping execution, sample number, so on and so forth. I think that that needs to be a larger priority. I've always said that. I think, you know, I would like him to continue to genuinely listen to other stakeholders in the sport. When I say other stakeholders, I mean stakeholders that aren't controlling the sport, such as riders, such as teams, such as, quite frankly, fans, that those stakeholders continue to be listened to and taken seriously, as opposed to seen as sort of nuisances. That would also be something I'd like to see from him.
I wonder whether we might be able to get a quick word with Mr. Carey, just about his interest in cycling. I mean, literally two and 3 minutes, and then we'll let you all go have your dinner, and then off to the theatre while we work our way through the wine list here.
All right, excellent. Yeah, I will go ask him, but I no assurances whatsoever. All right.
Cool. But it's about cycling.
Well, we kind of ended there, Lionel, tantalizingly setting up an interview with John Carey.
Yeah, unfortunately it didn't happen, but that's the way things go, isn't it? You know, you win some, you lose some. A bit like bike racing.
Yep, we'll get him. We'll get him.
Yeah.
We'll get him.
Yep.
But interesting, particularly to hear about, as I mentioned at the start, the new sponsor and, you know, what they're looking to get out of their association with a bike team. I like you, I wasn't familiar with the company. It's always surprising when you hear a company that you're not familiar with, just the size of it, you know, amazing.
Yeah, and really, when you think about how close to losing the team Jonathan Vaughters was, it's interesting that the saviour came from an area that you really wouldn't have associated with cycling. Possibly positive ramifications for the rest of the sport, really, because it can't just survive on sponsors that are just solely linked to cycling, you know, bike equipment and so on. It needs to branch out, broaden out, and bring in money from other walks of life, I guess.
Or just solely using riders as billboards, which, you know, is another interesting aspect. They're not the first to use it as an internal communications tool. CSC did that, of course, and other big companies do that. Sky do that a lot. But it's a good story. I mean, their involvement with cycling is a good story, and, you know, we look forward to telling that. I wonder if the security that they now have for 3 years at least will mean that we see Jonathan at more bike races. Because I feel, I didn't put this to him because he was looking over his shoulder for John Kerry, but you know, that team has struggled, and they had a great sort of second half of the season, started to click for them around May at the Giro. They have struggled, and I've sometimes wondered whether that owed something to the fact that the figurehead wasn't around. You know, I look at teams where the figurehead, Patrick Lefebvre at Quickstep, Dave Brailsford at Team Sky, they're both very visible, and I think that's important.
Yeah, interesting. I spoke to Brian Holm last week for something that we'll be putting out at some point in the nearest future, and he said that Patrick Lefebvre had said that this had been the most challenging year he'd ever had in cycling, simply because he was in the background trying to secure the future of the team, and it meant that it took him away from what he wanted to be doing, which was being that boss, being visible, being available for the staff and the riders. So bound to have an effect.
Before we go, I should mention that we released a new podcast last week, a pilot episode, the cycling podcast Brevet. It's an idea that we had. This side of the sport is really growing in terms of events and in popularity, endurance and ultra endurance cycling. And so this was a little test, really, to see what the interest was in that side of the sport. It was an interview with Mark Bowman, who recently broke the Around the World record, 78 days to ride, well, an average of 240 miles a day, which sounds even more impressive in kilometres.
Yeah, well, it's 300.
I worked it out the other day.
300.
It's more than, it's 360, isn't it?
Not 360, no. Is it?
We're keeping all this in.
Hang on, let me think, let me work this out. No, it's about, hang on.
100 miles is 160 kilometres.
Yeah.
Oh, so 200 miles is 320 kilometres, plus another 40.
Miles.
Which yeah, is miles, 25 kilometres. this is awful. What was wrong with that wine that we had earlier? There's only one glass. Oh God, it's 40 miles is about 60 kilometres. So
I think the listeners are ahead of us here.
So 380 kilometres. 380 kilometres a day,
roughly.
I mean, I couldn't even do that in one day, and nor could you.
I definitely couldn't. No. Anyway,
that was a wonderful little glimpse into our brains trying to add things up.
This time last year, we did a podcast that we called the Off Season Ramble. This is rapidly becoming the Off Season Shamble.
Let's do an Off Season Ramble again soon.
We should do.
We do have other unusual ones coming up. We've got a conversation between Ned Bolting and Orla Shinawy, which is really good. Touches on a lot of their shared interests in terms of the broadcast side of the sport, which is really good. So that's coming up soon. And the conversation with Chiro will come out 1 week. And other things, we've got one more special to come on Team Sunweb. Daniel's doing that. It'll come out soon for friends of the podcast. You can still become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you want more coherent podcasts than this one, there's a lot there behind our paywall. So do become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com for £10. And soon we'll be launching our 2018 package. Stay tuned for that.
Cool.
In the meantime, Lionel, we should get out of here before we're kicked
thrown
out.
Yeah. Well, we ought to pay our bill first.
So please do sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank you very much. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.